Hello and welcome to Power Problems. I'm John Glazer. My guest today is Dale Copeland, professor of international relations at the University of Virginia and author of the new book, A World Safe for Commerce, American Foreign Policy from the Revolution to the Rise of China. Dale, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, John.
What you try to do in this book, as you put it, is to lay out a general theory of great power behavior that can be applied across the full range of events in American foreign policy. And yours is a systemic realist explanation, and you pull in insights from both defensive and offensive variants. But before we get into your theory itself, I thought maybe it'd be good to start out with a brief discussion, as you do in the opening chapters, of kind of setting the theoretical context for your contribution here. You're drawing from a number of different IR theories and noting their limitations and their strengths, but then also making the point that you don't necessarily see these as competing theories in the first place, like a lot of other scholars might treat them.
Well, John, one of the things that orients the whole field of international relations has been this historical division between so-called realist scholars and liberal scholars. And realist scholars tend to focus on the idea of power, the fear of the future, and the need for power to be safe in the larger environment that great powers exist within. And liberal scholars tend to focus on domestic level variables, ideologies, and forces that bubble up, you might say, from below, and that tend to drive the way leaders of different sorts act in the world. So you have this divide between whether the system and power politics is the main force and or liberals. Liberal factors such as domestic politics are the main forces. And my view is to start at the system level with realism and focus on building a new and more dynamic power-based argument that also brings in commercial power and trade and not just military power. And then to see how much explanatory power you can get from looking at the world in that way, and then see in the cases whether this argument works relative to some of the liberal factors, such as in the case of the United States, American ideology, American domestic politics, the character and personality types of leaders, and so forth. So I'm not really trying to dispute that the liberal argument has a lot of value. What I'm trying to show is that we might have ignored the power of the systemic or power-driven logic, at least in the American case. We tend as Americans to look at Europeans or Japanese cases in world history and say, oh, yes, they were driven by power politics. But we tend to think of America as exceptional, or at least as a country that has more of a moral underpinning, a liberal underpinning to its foreign policy. And I'm trying to not overthrow that view, but trying to correct it by showing that, in fact, commercial and power-driven aspects of American foreign policy have been very, very important for 250 years from the get-go, from the very start of the American Republic in the Revolution and then in the 1790s and onwards. So that kind of gives me a different way to approach it. But again, not trying to destroy or undermine the other arguments, but to see what is the relative explanatory power of my argument, and indeed under what conditions my argument might be wrong, so that for foreign policy analysts officials in Washington, they can say, oh, okay, we might want to pull this Copeland tool out of the toolbox for these cases, but on other cases, we might want to choose a liberal argument, or we might want to choose something that's of a different form of realism, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense. Yeah, it's a level of intellectual humility that doesn't always come through in every scholar's book. You call your theory dynamic realism. I'll attempt a summation of it, and then you can elaborate or correct me wherever appropriate. Basically, you argue that long-term security for states makes high and growing levels of economic power a must. Great powers are dependent on trade and investment, and if their leaders expect that that trade and investment will continue, that state's likely to be moderate in its behavior. But if expectations for the future turn sour, that state's likely to be more aggressive and threatening if it thinks that some other state is trying to restrict it or cut it off economically. Do I have that roughly right?
Yeah, that's roughly right, John. I would say that there are two components, perhaps, to this realpolitik or realist-based logic. You've captured, in a sense, my second element, which is about expectations of future trade. And indeed, that has been my traditional approach to this question for the last 20 years, focusing on expectations of the future. If those expectations are positive about the commercial or trade environment, great powers tend to be quite happy about the situation. They're growing through trade, they're developing their technologies through trade. And they say, well, steady is the course, let's keep it going. This is great. Think of Japan in the 1920s or China, maybe up until about 2007 or 8. It was rising, China was rising very fast and through trade, and therefore had every incentive to be relatively moderate. And what my research for the last 20, 25 years has shown is that when those great powers start to feel that they're being cut off from the access to markets and raw materials, they start to turn nasty. They start to get worried about the future. They worry about their long-term power prospects because trade is the basis for economic power, and economic power is the basis for military power. And if indeed they start to fear deep and inevitable decline, as Japan did in 1941, when the U.S. was cutting it off from oil and raw materials, then they can become truly military menaces. They will perhaps attack the whole regional system if they have to. Now, that's one major component of this logic. But in this new book, actually, relative to my second book, which was called Economic Interdependence and War, I add a new element. And this new element is that when great powers look at the world, they realize that they need to have what I call strong economic power spheres. That is, even when they have pretty good senses of their future economic ability to grow, they worry that they need trading partners that will be secure and will be willing to trade with them. And you might say this is what I call the offensive realist side of my argument, namely that just that simple fear of being cut off later will lead great powers in history to develop their power spheres by expansion. What does that mean? Well, let's take the concrete example. The U.S. did worry about Britain in the 19th century, so it kept expanding across North America, expanding its influence in South America with the Monroe Doctrine, and then going all the way to Asia with the takeover of the Philippines in 1898-99. And why did they do that? Because they realized they needed to be able to have a secure sphere so that they could compete and so that they could deter or prevent others from cutting them off from those raw materials and markets. So in a way, it's a hedge. It's a way to secure your positive expectations for the future by having a secure power sphere, economic power sphere. The defensive realist side of my argument, which is essentially saying states, great powers, have to worry about causing others to be worried about them. That is, by overly aggressive expansion, they can cause others to raise their levels of arms spending, to form alliances against them, to indeed cut them off from raw materials and markets. So that part of the argument says, well, I want to be cautious about causing a spiral of mistrust and hostility that could get me into the very thing I'm worried about, namely being severed from my access to raw materials and markets. So this push and pull dimension of my argument is very important. It allows me to say that great powers may, like with the Belt Road Initiative, want to increase their expansion of their realms, economic realms, but they also want to be cautious about overly being too assertive in that push and causing the very thing they don't want, which is that restriction on raw materials and economic trade.
Okay, so let's get to some case studies and see if we can illustrate this. I'll say before we dive in that these were all very interesting. I could have easily spent a whole episode on just one of these chapters, but I also want to keep it reasonable in terms of time, so we won't explore each one. But let's start at the beginning, actually. You write about some of the dominant scholarly explanations for the American Revolutionary War, but you argue ultimately that it wasn't so much domestic politics or the highfalutin ideological explanations that drove the countries towards war, but rather fear in London that the American colonies might rise in economic power and be a loss for the British mercantile system. And then on the American side, they felt that the crown was trying to constrain their growth. And you say that this was the key dynamic that propelled them to war. Can you explain this a little bit more?
Yes, John. The case study, the first case study in the book, I call The Origins of the War of Colonial Independence. Because what I want to focus on is not that the Americans were, quote, revolutionaries from the beginning in ideological terms. Rather, they were thinking about their colonies as states, and they were grouping them together in a way that would fight back against what they perceived to be the economic restrictions of the British Empire. So here's the essence of the story for that chapter. And let me frame it in terms of the kind of competing arguments that are out there. The most obvious one is the one that we all know and love, that this was an ideological struggle. It was a battle driven basically by this fear that the Americans had, that the British would try to restrict their ideological lifestyle, if you will, the ability to have freedom from taxation, freedom from economic restrictions, freedoms of rights from the colonial governments, the colonial governors who, say, in Massachusetts were appointed by the British Crown. And that ideological argument has always been popular. It's the one we tend to be taught in high school. The second main argument, and it's, you might call it the neo-Marxist argument, is that no, this was driven by elites that were in some sense greedy for more. They wanted to fight the British so that they could control more of their bigger share of the pie. And in that sense, the elites got together both to stop the lower classes from growing in power and to keep the British at bay. Now, my argument is really a power-based logic, but it works the following way. It's not ignoring the idea that the Americans liked their lifestyle. In fact, talking to any of those British Americans at the time, as they call themselves British Americans, they saw themselves as British subjects. They liked the British lifestyle that they had grown to be accustomed to. They liked the ideology, going back to John Locke, of a certain level of freedom, political freedom for themselves. Needless to say, they also were willing, more than willing, to have slaves do most of the work for them, enslaved people. But ignoring that part of it for a second, everything was going quite swimmingly up until about 1762-63 for the Americans, because they had their trade. They could trade pretty well with anyone they wanted. They would ship goods directly to Britain, and they found that that was working for them. They were, in fact, the wealthiest people per capita on the face of the earth. They were wealthier per capita than even British citizens. What happened? Well, the British elite started to worry that the Americans were actually doing so well economically that in a few decades' time, they would actually overtake Britain in total economic power. And indeed, the whole center of the empire would shift from London to the east coast of British North America, and then perhaps even more westward as the Americans started to move over the Allegheny Mountains and move westward. Now, why would that be fearful for them? Benjamin Franklin saw this in 1751 and wrote a very famous piece that came out a couple of years later that basically said, look, British people in Britain, don't worry. We're growing, and we're doubling our population every 15 to 20 years. And yes, we will have more people than you and a larger economy in a few more years, call it maybe 2 decades, 3 decades. But that's okay, because we're British subjects and we're loyal. Well, the problem in international relations is if you see a rising power, in this case, the British North Americans were the rising power, and you're the declining and dominant actor, you do worry about the future because you don't necessarily trust their promises to be loyal later or to be peaceful later. So what did the British do? Well, the British decided that they needed to restrict that growth. They needed to restrict the growth of the British North American colonies so that the British North Americans would stay, in the phrase of the time, hewers of wood and drawers of water. In other words, suppliers of staple goods like tar, tobacco, basic lumber for building of ships and so forth. And they would accept British manufactured goods in that nice relationship between the two sides. All very well and good for the British, but the Americans, as they developed both their technology and their size, wanted to be more industrialized. They wanted to have the manufacturing at home. They wanted to export goods where they wanted to export them. And yes, they were loyal at the time, but there was no question that the British had a point. We don't know if you'll be loyal once you're more powerful. And in fact, in that chapter, I say this particular case is the greatest parallel to U.S.-China relations right now, where you see, it's a very ironic parallel, but we see the Americans now worried about a rise of China. We see China trying to commit itself to saying, look, don't worry about our economic growth. Once we're perhaps the largest GDP or nation economically in the world, we'll be nice, we'll be fine. And the Americans have, like all great powers, an incentive to restrict that economic growth. Now, they haven't done it fully yet. They're starting only with chips and semiconductors at the highest level, under 10 nanometers in particular. But they want, the Americans do, to make sure that the Chinese don't become a fully dominant and overtaking economic power, say, in another 15 to 20 years. So there's a parallel there we can get into later, I'm sure. But going back to the case of 1751 to 1776, what we see in this time is a huge amount of discussion revolving around this idea that the Americans might overtake the British in size and population and would have their own views of the world once that happened and would do independent things, even if they were nominally a part of the British Empire. So that gives you the sort of picture of the main dynamic. And all the things that we know and love from our history books, like the Stamp Act or the Currency Act or finally the Tea Act, are all part and parcel of the American perception that the British were trying to keep them down, to set up a glass ceiling so that they couldn't grow anymore. And the Americans reacted. They got the British to back off a couple of times. So we got all the way from 1763 to 1773, 10 years, without a war. And then suddenly by 1773, we have the Tea Act, which sends everything into a full-blown escalation to an all-out war by 1775 in Massachusetts, and then 1776, the Declaration of Independence. I'll stop there in case you want to ask a couple of other clarifying questions, but that's sort of the power-driven logic that counters the view that it's just about domestic politics or it's just about this love of freedom, which the Americans already had, you might say. So it's a love of freedom that was probably not the main motivating force. It was a fear of the future on both sides.
The Spanish-American War is another well-trodden case in the study of U.S. foreign policy with a lot of entrenched explanations for why it unfolded the way it did. But again, you argue the propelling factor of the war was, quote, the fear that if Washington did not act swiftly and forcefully, the future commercial base for long-term U.S. economic growth would be harmed, and so accordingly would overall national security. You do talk about a mix of motives that U.S. elites, and McKinley in particular, had for the war. And I encourage you to talk about some of those too, if you like. But ultimately, tell us why we should understand this as being driven by commercial dynamics.
John, that's a great question, because that particular chapter, or that case in particular, is probably the most difficult one for me to make my argument for. And I'm not a kind of person who wants to just sort of push an argument down someone's throat and say, oh, I have to be right. I actually show in the book that the Vietnam War in the early 60s, or the U.S. policy under Andrew Jackson in the late early 1830s, was probably not in alignment or aligned with what I want to argue. In fact, you know, I think there were other factors better than mine that were pushing those particular cases. But the McKinley case, or the splendid little war that we talk about, where the U.S. went in and saved the Cuban people from a humanitarian disaster, is often portrayed, at least in IR circles, international relations circles, as the case either of American value systems, humanitarian values, driving the U.S. into war, or it's often seen as a neo-Marxist argument, or a case that is the best illustration of the view that firms push leaders into wars they don't want. And why do they push them? Because of profits, because of fear that the companies are losing profits, or fear, or maybe even the greed-driven dynamic of getting more profits from the particular war. And of course, we have that debate going on in all the time. Think of the debate we have in 2003 about why did we go into Iraq? Well, one argument is we wanted to spread ideology. We wanted to make Iraq more safe for democracy. And indeed, apparently, George W. Bush did believe that he could spread democracy. Humanitarian goal, in a way. The other goal, of course, is we did it for oil. We did it for the oil companies that needed more profits and they wanted Iraqi oil. Well, I'm not going to get into the 2003 case, but let's go back to 1898. My point is not that those other motives might not have been there for some. The question is relative salience. What's really pushing McKinley, pushing him from being a reluctant imperialist, he didn't really want to do this when he first got into power, into a situation where by the early part of 1898, he actually said, yes, we have to do this. We have to go to war both against Spain for Cuba, but also for the Caribbean. Let's not forget, we acquired just not just Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, but we also acquired Puerto Rico. But for the Far East and the acquisition of Manila Bay as a port that we could project power into the China area, or the China market as it was called at the time, and Japan, so that we could have a foothold, not a dominant position, the British were dominant, but a foothold in that growing, burgeoning trade with China and Japan. So why does this alternative argument make more sense? Well, I can't go through the details of this very complicated case, but let me hit a few high points here. The first thing to realize is that McKinley, simultaneous with the war with Spain, pushed through the Congress, the agreement of the Congress to bring Hawaii into, not the Union, but into the U.S. as a territory. Now, that, of course, has a lot of ramifications for the future, because it allows the U.S. to control Pearl Harbor and project naval power to the Far East. Now, that's simultaneous with the desire to get the Congress to accept the Philippines in the midst of the war itself as a colony of the United States. And it's very interesting to me that McKinley decided to acquire Manila in early May of 1898, before he had even really started the war against Spain in the Atlantic, in other words, against Cuba itself. He had already allowed Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, that is, an undersecretary of the Navy, to push our commander in Hong Kong to take Manila Bay at the very start of this war. Again, many months before we really fought the Spanish in a big way over Cuba. And Dewey acted very quickly, took Manila Bay in a couple of weeks, and McKinley redeployed 20,000 American troops away from the front with that would have been the front with Cuba across the Pacific to take Manila Bay. Why? Because the Germans wanted Manila Bay. The British were hovering around. They had their own position already. And this was a perfect way to project commercial power into the China area. Now, this was, as I show in the book, a longstanding goal from the 1840s and before to project power into the Far East so that the U.S. would have a dominant commercial position there. So the long and short of it here is that there's an alternative motive here that has nothing to do with the humanitarian disaster, which was there in Cuba. It has to do with projecting commercial strength all the way across the Pacific. That doesn't mean, again, that McKinley didn't care about the Cuban people that were suffering under Spanish rule. They were suffering, and he probably did feel that. But it hadn't motivated him for the first 2 years. Why in his early part of his second year did he suddenly decide to push for this? And what I also show by going back through the documents is that this was not an inadvertent war that he kind of stumbled into because of pressure. He actually had a plan, and in fact, he manipulated the Spanish, a liberal democracy, he manipulated them into conflict by exploiting the very fact that they had to discuss this with their parliament. He delayed negotiations till he had what he wanted at home so that he could get the Spanish to not cave into his demands so that he could get the war going. And this is a very untold aspect of the war that most of the time people say, oh, this was a splendid little war that McKinley sort of fell into in very quick succession of pressure from firms, pressure from congressmen. No, he had no pressure from the firms because they didn't really care that much about Cuba per se. He had no pressure for them from the firms, even for the China market, because they were actually doing better at home by 1897. The recession was largely over by that point. So where was the pressure coming from? It was coming, actually, ironically, from the Europeans. The Germans and the British and the French, who had already taken Vietnam, were already penetrating the fabled markets of the Far East. And if the U.S. was to keep growing as a great power, it couldn't just rely on its home markets. That's the key point. The key point is that all great powers, like the Chinese right now with Belt Road, recognize that they reach a certain point in their growth curve where unless they expand their economic power sphere even more, they won't be able to sustain a high growth rate. It's not that they haven't been growing, they have. But just like the Chinese in about 1997, in fact, but especially after 2008, they realize that unless they expand and not grab, but to control a larger commercial sphere, they won't be able to get the markets and the cheap raw materials that will sustain, you know, a 5 or 6% growth rate that they come to expect. And the Americans were in the same boat as China is in about 2007. And Xi Jinping recognizes this right away. As soon as he gets into power in early 2013, he says, oh my gosh, our growth rates are not 10 or 12% anymore. If we can get 5 to 6% growth, what he calls the new normal, we'll be happy. And the way to get that, of course, is through what he calls very quickly a Belt Road Initiative, or Belt and Road Initiative. And that doesn't mean, in the American case, taking over the Philippines by force. It means having more connections with those states so that the cheap raw materials and the markets are there for China's next phase of growth.
I want to promise both you and the listeners that I will get to China. We're going to skip ahead here in history quite a bit to the end of World War II and the Cold War, but maybe I want to interrupt our flow here and just ask you to talk about and sort of remind listeners about Alfred Thayer Mahan, because that That idea becomes important around this time and through to, you know, Roosevelt's grand area and so on, and might be useful for people to just get a quick reminder about the Mahanian idea.
Well, the Mahanian idea in a nutshell was that for any great power in history, or at least ones that wanted to keep their economic power strong so they could stay militarily strong, you needed to have trade connections around the world supported by a strong navy. It's a very simple idea. And in fact, Mahan, I have no evidence directly of this, but Mahan must have probably got this from reading Alexander Hamilton, who had the same idea in the 1790s. And indeed, Alexander Hamilton got this idea from reading a lot about the British Empire. So it's not surprising that Mahan's first and famous book in 1891, I believe it was all about the history of the British Empire up to the end of the Napoleonic Wars. Well, why did he pick that period and why did Hamilton see the exact same pattern? Because what Mahan saw and what Hamilton saw is that the British became the world's dominant commercial and naval power through this very technique of extending their trade connections first and then backing it up and supporting it by a strong navy. The navy, of course, has two roles. One is to deter trading partners from cutting you off. And the other is to protect that trade as it goes back home and is used for essential development at home. And the British perfected this. The Americans, under Mahan's guidance, started to perfect this after his book came out. But they were already starting with Benjamin Harrison's changes in 1888. But Mahan, in some sense, solidified the very grand strategic notion that that was the way to become, like the British, a very dominant and long-term great power. And to this day, the Americans have that Mahanian instinct, if you will. They have locked up from 1945 onwards an arc of power. I like to call it the FDR's legacy, Roosevelt's legacy, but this arc of commercial power that extends all the way from Britain, Western Europe, through the Middle East, all the way through India, now sort of with China, but all the way to Japan and Southeast Asia. And that allows the Americans to have their naval connections and trade connections to those vital areas for American economic power. And to, of course, simultaneously bottle up any Eurasian state, whether it was Nazi Germany in 1942 or the Soviet Union 45 onwards or China today, so that those states cannot develop, or at least only develop on American terms. And that's part of the Mahanian brilliance as well. Again, Hamiltonian, which is that power is always relative, and naval power and commercial power are relative. And what Hamilton saw in 1790 is that the British had it and we don't, and we have to therefore industrialize and develop our naval power to match them. The Chinese recognized this, that they didn't have it in the disastrous 1996 Taiwan Straits crisis, where they were the chicken, they were playing the chicken game and they had to swerve because the Americans were overwhelmingly superior. Well, the Chinese have been building up and building up since then, just like the Americans built up after Mahan's famous book of 1890, to do what? To achieve that, not dominance, that's the key. In both cases, the Americans were not, at least even under Wilson and the subsequent presidents, were not seeking dominance. They were seeking to protect and develop that larger economic power sphere. Same with China. China can't and is not trying, despite some of the alarmists, is not trying to achieve global naval dominance. It can't do it, and it would be incredibly wasteful to its own economy. But to protect its trade routes, definitely, it needs that naval power. To increase its own leverage, that's key. You want to have leverage against trading partners as well as adversaries so that you can say to them, look, you can't make us swerve anymore in these chicken games. We're a Mack truck too. You're a Mack truck and we're a Mack truck. And both of us don't want to even get on the road to chicken, as I like to say. You want to make sure that the other knows that you are strong enough so that the status quo of high levels of trade can continue. The Americans did it because they followed the British model. The irony, of course, is that China's doing it following the American model. And the Mahanian logic is embedded in Chinese thinking. And so I'm not saying that Mahan was such a brilliant guy that he changed the world. He made it true. It was true that the Germans and the Japanese followed Mahan in the period prior to World War I. But what is brilliant about Mahan is that he channeled the British grand strategic thinking that Hamilton in the 1790s made clear to Washington and to all of his followers that the Americans had to do.
So you write, it was not Soviet aggression in 1945 that sparked the Cold War, as traditionalists would argue. Rather, it was U.S. worry that communist revolutions would lead to the loss of smaller states to the closed Soviet economic sphere. Can you elaborate on what you think were the principal factors that produced the Cold War?
John, it's an excellent question, because we tend to think, and I keep coming back to China because it is my obsession, we keep thinking, well, China under Xi Jinping, he's a communist, he must have parallels with early Soviet foreign policy behaviors, particularly Stalin after 1945. And Stalin started the Cold War, so the Cold War must be driven now. If there is a Cold War, there is not. But if it were to become a Cold War, it must be because of Chinese aggression. Now, I am all in favor of keeping our power strong in the Far East right now and making sure Taiwan can deter any kinds of leveraging that the Chinese might want to do against Taiwan. But we need to understand our history correctly so that we don't make false parallels. And the real driving force of the Cold War, why it became a Cold War, because remember, the Soviet Union and the U.S. were allies for 3.5 years during World War II. They fought against Hitler. They worked together through 3 different conferences to make sure that they could defeat both Hitler and the Japanese, which was an amazing achievement. And in 1944-45, as they knew the European war was coming to an end, and as they suspected that Japan would ultimately fall, they had to start thinking very seriously about what the shape of the post-war environment would be. Now, what we have to say is that the traditional, it's called the traditionalist argument of the Cold War, is that we just wanted to go back to normalcy. They wanted to aggress. They wanted to expand into Western Europe and the Middle East and the Far East. And only by 46, late 46, 47, did we, quote, wake up to this incredible threat and start to deter it. And that became the containment strategy that George Kennan labeled in the mid-1947 period, the Truman Doctrine, and so forth. That's the traditionalist view. They started the Cold War. We had to respond. We were the good guys, if you will. My point is that we don't need to put any kind of moral labels on who, quote, started the Cold War. Let's look at the dynamic of 44, 45 and see what kinds of factors on both sides forced the two states to end their alliances or the alliance ties that they had during World War II and turn to a more hostile view of the other, to a point where arms racing and, you know, development of nuclear weapons became the hallmark of the Cold War. Well, here's in a nutshell the essence of my argument, is that since great powers, as I've said, need to have larger economic power spheres to have the stability and strength at home to be military territorial powers, both the Soviets and the U.S. in 1944, not 45, but 44, realized that they would want to control parts of Europe for that larger purpose. In other words, the Americans were keen on having Western Europe as part of their economic power sphere, and the Soviets, of course, wanted Eastern Europe. Now, that was good, and in fact, they kind of agreed to that in November of 43, that would be the division. And it was even done with matchsticks, if you will, to divide up Poland and move it westward and to have a certain line. And everyone, including Churchill, but Roosevelt and Stalin, agreed to that. And it was a very cooperative conference. This is Tehran, November 43. Now, fast forward to the end of 44, what do you see? You see that Roosevelt, under the advice of people like Bullitt and others, including Harriman and George Kennan, who's actually under Harriman in Moscow, are saying, now, sir, we have to worry that the Soviet sphere will be very closed off economically from ours. The Soviets have what we call an autarkic way to think of things. They like to grab states, bring them into communism, and then make them trade only with Moscow, or at least with the Soviet Union. Why do we have to worry about that? Because if communism starts to spread, not just in Eastern Europe, which it already had because of Soviet influence, but into Western Europe or Middle East or the Far East, those states, if they, quote, turn communist, just by revolution, just by internal dynamics, because don't forget, the war was incredibly devastating, and the communist freedom fighters in France and the communists in Italy were making the argument, quite plausibly, that this is the time now to turn to the socialist end of the spectrum and help the people get food and basic resources. And yet, what they realized is that if those, quote, states of Western Europe went communist, they would just voluntarily agree to be a part of the Soviet economic sphere. That would cut us off from that vital sense of markets and raw materials and investments that we need to be and continue to be in that arc that I talked about, the dominant economic power of the world. In fact, what's really fascinating for me is that this goes back to a seminal moment in the mid part of 1940, when the Soviets weren't the threat, the Nazis were the threat, and the Council on Foreign Relations gave a series of direct arguments and documents to, at the time it was FDR and his underlings, to say that this, quote, grand area that we need to set up, which I call the ARC or the FDR legacy, that grand area is required if we're going to stop any European hegemon or potential hegemon from dominating the world. At the time, it was the fear of the Nazis. 2 years later, after Stalingrad, it became the fear of the Soviets. And so by late 42, early 43, we're already shifting our thinking to how do we keep our sphere strong and avoid encroachment, even if it's not by Soviet desire, this encroachment that would be caused by the popularity of communism and the fear of communist revolts in Western Europe and elsewhere.
For those listeners who end up getting the book, it's really fun to move on to your description of the end of the Cold War. But again, we've got time constraints. So let's move on to China, which you address in a compelling final chapter. Hal Brands and Michael Beckley published a book utilizing some of your past work, actually, arguing essentially that China's economic power has already peaked and it's therefore due to become a lot more hostile and aggressive and may soon invade Taiwan and aggress against the Philippines and so on. Basically, they're saying it's a 5-alarm fire now, and we need to act more forcefully to try to contain China. And you offer a critique, and I'll quote you here. Assuming worst case in the early stages, given the dynamics of spiraling, could create the very bad apple that one hopes to avoid, a rising state obsessed with the idea that only all-out expansion will save it. Do you want to talk a bit about the Brands and Beckley argument or the pessimistic take in general and why the dynamics of spiraling should give us pause here?
Sure, John. The key to the Brands and Beckley book from 2022 called Danger Zone, The Coming Conflict with China. And Mike and I go way back and we've had a number of Zoom calls since the book came out and before. And, you know, Mike will say, yeah, we really liked your first book about rise and fall. And we like the idea that when states pass a peak of power and start to decline, they become very assertive and aggressive. And you've heard me talk about that. When states feel they're being constrained economically, like Japan 41 or even the Americans in 1773, they start to lash out or they fight to maintain their position and not decline. And so, in general, as a theoretical point, I like that idea. at my point to Mike by Zoom, but also now in, more in print, as I've been debating this on Twitter or X with many people, is that China, A, doesn't believe, or the Chinese leaders don't believe that they're declining. They got 5% growth last year. They got 9% growth 2 years before that. Yes, they had not a great 2022, which was, I think, 3% growth, but they're not quite at the new normal that Xi Jinping wants, which is 6%, but they're probably hovering around 4 to 5% growth, and that's pretty darn good. And that's actually a little bit better than the American growth rate, which has been booming lately, but hey, that's good for both sides to have positive growth, because then you don't worry about the future and you don't worry about being overtaken by the other state. Now, where does Branson Beckley think this leads? They believe, and they're right, that China has some severe internal economic problems, including demographic aging of a population, some debt problems, environmental problems, which we all know about. And they believe that these are, if you will, inevitable problems that will cause them to, in the language of my first book, decline deeply and inevitably. My point to Mike again, this was from Zoom calls, is no, they think they can recover from these problems, or they think they can develop. They've done it before where they slowed down in the late 90s and then in the early 2000s, and they came back with a gangbust with a very strong growth rate. And the key point is perception. If they believe that the real problem is the Americans and their domestic system that makes the Americans likely to decline, then they have no reason, if they're still a rising power, to kick into that preventive dynamic where we've got to go now and take Taiwan while we're still strong. No, they'll probably just wait it out if they keep believing that they're rising. And I think they are still rising. That's the key aspect. Now, here's where it gets interesting, though, because what I try to lay out in the book, this is A World Safe for Commerce, the new book, is that we shouldn't try to take snapshots in time or even try to look into a crystal ball and say, ooh, this is what's going to happen in 10 years. Rather, we should look at different scenarios and ask, to what extent can our theory and our evidence help explain how the U.S. should respond to each of the scenarios that could happen? Now, here are the four main scenarios that come out of two main variables. The key variable is probably the power one. To what extent can China really catch up and overtake the U.S. in total GDP, in total economic power? Is that possible? It looks like they might get back on that track and overtake us in 10 years, or maybe they'll peak. That's not known, and we can't foresee that. But the second variable is, to what extent do we think China will have domestic changes such that it will move away from being what I call a rational security maximizer, that is, a state that's primarily driven by rational security needs, including needs of population at home. And to what extent will it be driven primarily by glory or ideology or greed or some things that are not just security driven? Now, put those two things together and you can see you can get four different scenarios. Right now, we're superior in economic power and China's largely security and maximizing. But it could be that they overtake us and become the opposite kind of state, more of a truly a dangerous state like Stalin or even a Hitler state. That would be very scary, but we're not there. So what we should do, therefore, and I have a number of charts in the book, A World Safe for Commerce, by saying, look, by these charts, there are at least four different pathways that we could go. Let's analyze each one and make plausible, balanced suggestions for U.S. foreign policy as we move along the pathway. Knowing, of course, that even if China is growing, it might indeed, in the Beckley and Brand sense, peak early and therefore be more dangerous. But guess what? Brands and Beckley, now reversing the order, it's Beckley and Brands in Foreign Policy just recently published a new piece 2 years after the book that is much more cautious, much more restrained, much more nuanced, saying, hey, we don't know, and then nobody knows where things will go, but we should make sure we keep Taiwan strong. And that I agree with. I totally agree with. And they're not even saying that it's inevitable anymore that China is declining. They're just saying, oh, we don't know. Well, nobody knows. So let's look at those scenarios and then make balanced strategies along the way, each step of the way, so that we don't do two things. We don't push China into a corner by economically encircling it or causing it to fear the future like Japan 41. Let's keep trading on most areas, not high-tech chips, but on most areas where they can grow and get their 4% growth. That's good because it keeps them stable and nice. And then the second thing is let's also make sure we do have our power strong and our alliances strong in East Asia so that when it comes to, quote, deterrence, we're there. The allies don't doubt our resolve. Taiwan is strong enough to cause the costs of any invasion to be very high so that China would say, ooh, that's not worth it. And we also project our resolve to do very strong economic sanctioning if China decides to invade Taiwan. These are all contingencies. In other words, we don't just start with a containment strategy, assuming the worst, which is kind of the way Elbridge Colby and other alarmists are talking. We start with the idea that if China's backing away from Wolf Warrior diplomacy, as it is, and talking about the future and wanting trade, then let's give them the trade that gives them the stability at home and the sense that they're not declining so that they stay nice. And we tell them in return, here's the deal. You have to promise, or at least you have to make sure that you won't do anything against Taiwan unless they do something really stupid like declare independence. And that's what she has already assured Biden of. And guess what? We then put pressure on the Taiwanese government, the new DPP leader Lai, to say, don't talk about independence. Don't at all talk about independence, even hint at it. And that's what Lai is doing to a T. He's so silent that the third place party, TPP, has said, you know, why don't you talk about independence anymore? I thought you were big on that. No, be quiet. We're not going to talk about that because that might upset the Chinese. So this is it's in some ways the right solution right now, which is that we don't want China to decline. So keep trading. Don't decouple. That's good. We've made that clear to China. We'd also made it clear that we've moved more aircraft carriers into the area. We're building up Taiwan. So don't even think that you can just sort of invade Taiwan with no cost. There'll be huge military costs and even higher economic costs as we sanction your regime and cut off, you know, oil through the Malacca Straits. And it's a good deterrent strategy because deterrence, as Tom Christensen and others have emphasized, is about both making sure that if a person thinks about attack, the cost would be high, but also reassuring them that if they act nicely, they will get the goodies that will allow them to grow and be a stable state at home.
So let's talk about that balance of deterrence and reassurance, or carrots and sticks, so to speak, because while Brands and Beckley may have moderated their argument somewhat, the politics in Washington don't seem to lean towards moderation on this. There's a lot of increasing hawkishness and kind of hysteria about China. And towards the end of the book, you offer several pieces of advice to policymakers on China. All of them are worth absorbing, but here's one that you write. Americans must remember that China's high level of economic dependence can act both as a constraining factor for peace, if positive expectations of future trade continue, and a propelling force for war if these expectations turn negative. This means that the issue of peace or war in East Asia is very much in the hands of U.S. policymakers. That's kind of what you were just talking about, but I wonder if you can elaborate on this balance of carrots and sticks, because it seems my view of Washington is that it just leans towards the sticks way too much.
Well, there's always a course correction in these things. And I do agree with, say, Bridge Colby and others that we haven't done enough in the last 20 years, going way back, to make sure that China understood that our military is strong. This is a chicken game of Mack trucks. And while they may now be a Mack truck, they weren't 30 years ago. Neither of us want to get on the road to chicken because we're both very strong. And the costs of war would be very high. And our resolve to defend or to help Taiwan, that is, not with American troops, but with equipment, is very strong as well. And we've got Japan on board for that. India's on board. Australia. We've got that deterrent posture. What I hear in Washington is, yes, a shift even of the Democrats towards what you might call the hawkish end of the spectrum. But we have to be, I think, careful to avoid alarmism, if you will, if that's the right word, and say, we did it in the Cold War. Let's shift over to containment. Let's decouple our economies and let's drive them into the ground economically, as we did actually so effectively with the Soviet Union, to the point when Gorbachev would have to come to Washington in 87 and say, I'll get rid of my missiles and out of Afghanistan if you just give us trade and technology. Well, that was leveraging and it got us out of the Cold War, but we don't have to get into a Cold War if we don't want to. Why? Because a Cold War is almost by definition a time of great instability and worries about people with fingers on buttons and Cuban Missile Crises. Neither side wants that. What do we need? Well, we need to have, as I think Biden is doing, but we need more of it, a strong force posture in East Asia. We also need to have, again, our alliances there to make that deterrent threat credible. Good. We're doing that. We also need to restrict the kinds of economic trade, say in under 10 nanometer chips, that could help the Chinese develop very accurate missiles and, of course, dominate economically in certain areas such as cell phone technology that right now the West is still dominant in. So keep our edge there. And that's all important and very much rational. Now, why could economic dependence, because China is very economically dependent in a way that the Soviet Union or other great powers in history have not been. Let me just give you one quick statistic. Before World War I, the British did have a very high level of economic dependence. About 40% of their GDP was built or caught up in trade. The Germans were less, around, I think, 29 or 30%. But the Germans were worried about their dependence as well, and it was one of the things that pushed them into war. But China has around 40% of its GDP caught up in trade, exports and imports. And that's an incredibly high historical figure. It was up to 59% for a while. And they, through lots of effort, got it down to 40. They want it to be closer to the American rate of about 22, 23% of GDP. Why? Because when you are relatively dependent on the world, and remember, by the way, that the British figure I gave you included all the colonial trade, which wasn't real dependence because, with Canada and India, you say, hey, trade with us. Oh, okay. China is dependent on the world. It has, let's give another figure that's very essential to understand. China has 10 times as much trade with the EU and the US than it has with Russia. Russia is its nominal partner in all of this, authoritarian bloc and so forth. But despite its own best efforts to have more independence from the EU and the US, China is still to this day very dependent. In fact, trade with the US is higher than ever. And China does not want to decouple. That's an American choice. Why does China not want to decouple? Because China has another thing that's very different from this ex-Soviet Union, very unstable situation at home. We all remember Tiananmen Square, but they are obsessed in Beijing with another Tiananmen Square. And how could that happen? Only by decline in their economic growth. That's what they know. That's why they need trade, because trade is 40% of GDP. Just, work through the numbers and you can see how that matters to them. And they need the cheap raw materials and they need the markets to keep that growth going. Now, in that relative asymmetry of dependence. And yes, the US is dependent on China for buying, treasury bills to keep its debt going or allowing the US to have a debt. But China doesn't really matter as much to the U.S. economy as the economy of the U.S. and EU and the American sphere, all these allies that the U.S. has, to China. Now, given that relative leverage, why is that good? Why is that potentially bad? It's good because if we play our cards right, and I think we're doing this right now, we can have a good force posture, but we're not in their face and we're not threatening to attack them. So they're not fearing a military attack. They're just saying, oh, well, you know, you're deterring us. But if we also simultaneously say, while we're strong militarily, we're still a Mack truck, we are actually going to keep trading with you as long as you play nice. And that creates what I call positive expectations for future trade that make the Chinese say, oh, this is not Japan 1941. We're in a good situation. We're getting the cheap raw materials. They're allowing Belt Road to penetrate even into South America, their backyard, because, hey, it probably helps all these smaller countries develop their own economies, and that's good for the world. And it's not a direct threat. That's the positive side. We control this because we have the great alliance spheres. We have that arc that I've talked about from Britain all the way to Japan. Japan is pushing, China is pushing against that larger U.S. hegemonic historical position. And it can keep doing that without upsetting us too much, as long as it doesn't make colonies out of these Southeast Asian states, as long as it doesn't try to do what European powers have done for many centuries and create empires, true empires. And that's good. That's the good side of this. Now, where can all of this turn bad? If you think about the potential causes of conflict and war in the world right now, where would you put it? Well, it's not going to be conventional war in the traditional European sense, because nuclear weapons are there and nobody wants an escalation to that. China also geopolitically is not like the Soviets. It doesn't have a foothold in Europe as well as in Asia. It's only in the Far East. And that means it has to look towards the Pacific and is constrained by its geography, because it has to get through the Malacca Straits to get its oil. It has to get through these islands to get iron ore from Australia. So that's not a good thing for China, but it's a good thing for us if we play it right. Now, in a world safe for commerce, I do, of course, talk about this, and I can't get into a lot of detail, but here's the essence of it. Why could it turn bad if we overreact? If we think, oh my gosh, the Chinese are getting ready to invade Southeast Asia, why would they do that, right? I mean, you can't get anything through the Malacca Straits if you don't have the Indian Navy and the American Navy on your side. And they would not be very kind about getting oil through the Malacca Straits for China if China took over Southeast Asia by force. So that's just that's outrageously alarmist to even think that. But if we did start to say to ourselves, oh, China's so strong, they're ready to attack, we've got to cut them off economically, we have to choose decoupling. We're not doing it now, but we have to choose it. Well, what could that be? It would make the positive expectations that China has, and of course that growth rate that goes with it, kick into the opposite. It would be more like Japan 41, where they might say, oh, we're, instead of growing 4%, we're declining 4% a year. Our people are upset. There might be another Tiananmen Square kind of revolt. We might have to go to war both to get resources and markets and open them up, but of course, divert the population's attention from problems at home. And that happens in history. The Chinese know this. Hey, there might be a good little war with Taiwan as a last resort when we see such problems at home that we might have revolts in 10 or 15, 20 cities. Remember in Tiananmen Square 89, there were over 200 cities. It wasn't just Beijing. It was over 200 cities where these student and worker revolts were very, very strong. And Deng Xiaoping almost lost the whole thing. If it hadn't been for the use of force, he probably would have. They don't want to do that again. She made that very clear in his first year. We will not have another Tiananmen Square. But if it's 4% decline or 10% decline because of U.S. restrictions. Imagine if we cut off oil. 75% of China's oil comes from abroad, and 80% of that comes through the Malacca Straits from places like Africa and Middle East. If we were just to say, okay, we're going to make your economy suffer right now, out of the blue, we cut off all that oil, China would start to decline probably 4% in the first year and probably 10% after that. And all the cars would stop, or a lot of the cars would stop, the shipping within China would stop. Really problematic. But guess what? We don't have to do any of that. We can make this contingent on their behavior. We can say, we have the power to do that. You're dependent on us and not vice versa, or not. It's asymmetric. We could cut you off in a second, and we won't. Won't, because you're playing nice, because you're not doing the nasty things that some people say you might do. Keep staying with the status quo, and we'll allow that trade, that raw material trade in particular, to grow. We won't do what we did in 1941 that led to Pearl Harbor. That's a good way to think about the world, because if economic interdependence is probably the most important force for peace, at least in the Chinese mind, and also the one thing that might lead them to do something as stupid as try to take over Southeast Asia or Taiwan, we have the power in our policy to both deter and to reassure at the same time. And let me just say one last thing, John, if I can. We tend to think of policy on a spectrum, like, oh, we're either hardline or softline. Ooh, we're hawkish or dovish. If you think about it as a box rather than as a single spectrum, you can have one, say, the vertical scale being how strong are we on our military posturing? And there I would say, yes, let's stay strong. Let's be strong on our military posture. But if the horizontal axis is something like how much do we engage them economically and how much do we allow coupling to continue rather than decoupling, there we can also be reassuring by saying, hey, we will simultaneously have a strong military posture while we have a moderate and engaging economic posture. We won't do the Cold War strategy, which was to do both nasty things at the same time. We can have a balance between those two dimensions. And that's smart strategy. That's not thinking on a single spectrum. That's thinking in a box perspective, where we can be, in this view, sort of at the top corner. We're both strong militarily, but we're also engaging them economically. We can avoid their fears of decline, at the same time raise the costs and risks of any military action through our strong alliances and defending of our allies. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I would say the thrust of the advice for policymakers in that sense is don't overreact, as you said, which is great. I think if you're a policymaker, you should just have to get that tattooed on your forehead or something. Dale Copeland, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Congratulations on this excellent book.
Well, I appreciate it, John. I really do. It's been great to talk to you.